Being best man for a friend is supposed to be an honor. Well, I was once best man for somebody I didn't know. He lived in San Francisco. His parents were friends of my parents at church, and that's why the wedding was here. His parents asked me to stand in as best man since he didn't know anybody here. So that morning, I got all dressed up and I was told to show up at their house for pictures. And it turned out to be a really awkward experience, having every relative who came to the house that morning see me hanging around and say, "Who's that guy?" Well, talk about imposter syndrome. All day I was in that place of honor next to the groom, but it felt wrong. It felt like I was sitting in somebody else's seat. Today's passage in Luke 14, we find Jesus at a dinner party where people are fighting over where to sit. Roman dinner party is less Thanksgiving feast at your house and more like Survivor, the TV show. Do you watch that? When I first heard about the show 23 years ago, about putting a group of strangers on an island to see who survives, I thought it was about seeing how strangers end up working together. But it turned out to be quite a bit meaner than that, because at the end of every show, they sit around to vote somebody out. And so the way to stay in the show is to make friends and form alliances so you're not the odd person out. But to win, at the end, you have to start scheming and betraying your friends. You have to find a sneaky way to strategically get your friends voted off at the right time so you are the only one left standing. So the slogan is to outwit, outplay, outlast. I've only ever saw one season of it. I find it very hard to watch people turning on each other behind their backs. So somehow, Jesus got invited to this Survivor dinner party at the house of a prominent leader in Jewish society, someone from the Pharisee party, known for their strict and proper opinions when it comes to living the law. From the moment Jesus came in the door, he had all eyes on him. People trying to size him up to see if he was with them or against them, or how much of a threat he was to them, or whether he might be someone with pull. This is the survivor mentality if you live in empire. Empires are built on shock and awe power. The way to survive empire is to figure out the pecking order and do everything you can to get more power by moving up the ladder, by shimmying up to the powerful people, get into their power circles, by pretending to be their friends even if you can't stand them, and plotting to get rid of competitors. Since other people are doing that to you at the same time, you have to also be watching your back. So empires are lonely places, tiring places. It's unsafe. You're always wondering who's out to get you, even as you're washing blood off your own hands. And it doesn't take very long for people to stop trusting each other, to stop seeing people as people, but just stepping stones to the up the ladder or an annoying pebble under your sandal to kick aside. So right away, Luke introduces us to a casualty of the empire way of life. At this dinner party is a man sick with what we would call edema. His vital organs are in failure, so water is pooling around his joints and arms and legs, causing painful swellings. By the medical opinion of his day, this man is dying. But this very sick man still feels like he needs to show up for this dinner because his family's social survival depends on it. But seemingly, nobody bothers with him because he's no longer important in their power game. Because it's a networking dinner gone wrong, where the guests are only interested in sucking the power out of relationships, but not actually the people in the relationships. Now, it's a Sabbath meal, so it's either the one on Friday night or one of the two on Saturday. During the 24 hours in the Jewish week, where commandment number four tells people to stop work and rest. So when Jesus sees the sick man, he asks the host and his Pharisee allies, "So is it okay to heal the man on the rest day?" While rabbis and teachers of other schools argue about exactly what is allowed and not allowed on the Sabbath day, the Pharisees, because they're from the strict school, the answer is clearly no. That the way the Pharisees understand their faith is that rules are rules, and at times God makes people choose between loving God by following the rules and loving people. But strangely, when Jesus asks if it's okay to heal the sick man on the Sabbath, the host and his people hesitate to answer. It cannot be that they don't know the answer. So probably they're working the room to see how they should answer. In a room like the one Jesus is in, there's something called the halo effect, which means before somebody says something, they want to see who the most powerful person in the room is and make sure what they say is in line with that powerful person. They say in Korea, in office staff meetings, nobody dares to challenge the boss's ideas, even when it's clearly wrong. And nobody wants to offer a better idea than the boss, so team brainstorming doesn't happen there. Everybody disagrees with the boss. There's also something called the bandwagon effect, where instead of the boss, what is important is to go with the popular opinion, that it's safer to blend in and vote with the group than to stand out and be shot down by the group. Jesus' question got all the wheels turning, so at this dinner party on the rest day, while they insist it's not okay to work to heal a sick man, their work of power jockeying never stops, not even on the Sabbath, because that's the empire way of life. So without waiting for an answer, Jesus heals the man and sends him home to really get some rest. Now, it would be a misunderstanding at this point to conclude that Jesus breaks a rule out of compassion. This is not what Jesus is doing here. Jesus says, if your child or your ox is drowning, would you not save them just because it's a Sabbath? He's asking, is this how you understand God? That he would make a rule more important than a human life? In Luke 6 and Mark 2, Jesus calls himself the Lord of the Sabbath. I am the authority on the Sabbath, he says, and I'm telling you that God's idea of the Sabbath is to create life in you, not to kill you. When Jesus was asked what is the most important of all of God's commandments, he says, love God and love your neighbor. This is how rabbis summarize the left and right tablets where God wrote the Ten Commandments. That the most important thing about the commandments is love. It's giving life and saving life in our relationship with God and each other. So Jesus is telling them they're reading the Bible wrong. Jesus says God does not put rules over someone's life. It's not a violation of Sabbath rules to save a life, because compassion and mercy and life-giving is the commandment that is the objective of all commandments. And in fact, the commandments command them to love and be merciful all day, all the time, above all else. So Jesus didn't break a rule. He was actually showing them what is true faithfulness to the rules as God meant it. How did people like the Pharisees go wrong, do you think? Chicken or the egg? Is it their misunderstanding of the law that got them doing it wrong and made their hearts hard as a result? Or did the problem start before that? That their hearts were made hard by empire life, by them dabbling in idolatry, worshiping dead things, and their love of power, that they were already hardened and hard on people. So they began practicing their religion that way. 1,000 years ago, the French monk Bernard de Clairvaux wrote, "What we love, we shall grow to resemble." So as if their feathers are not ruffled enough with this theological controversy, now Jesus makes fun of them about their empire power play. He notices that everyone is competing for the best seats around the dinner table, probably the ones closest to the host, so whoever is the most influential person in the room. If you've been to a Chinese wedding banquet, I hate to be the one to tell you that how important you are to the couple and the families is entirely measured by how far your table is to theirs. The truth is, if you're sitting at table 44 or 84, you're lucky you got invited. You can be grateful for that, and at least you ate the same food. Well, that's what people at Jesus' dinner are thinking. They don't want to be in a cheap seat. So Jesus makes fun of them and tells them a parable. Beware of presuming to take a good seat, only to be sent back to the cheap seats and be humiliated in front of everybody. Wouldn't be a smarter power move to take the really cheap seat and see the host freak out to see you there and sweat over the social media backlash? So he makes a big to-do to come and get you and in front of everyone move you into the good seat. Isn't that a smarter way to get noticed, Jesus says. Jesus is actually quoting King Solomon in Proverbs 25, 6-7, but in a really cheeky way. Do not exalt yourself in the king's presence, Solomon says, and do not claim a place among the great men. It is better for him to say to you, come up here, than for him to humiliate you before his nobles. Proverbs 25 is all about the king and how he chooses his advisors. Solomon starts by saying the king is very important. Not quite as important as God, but way more important than everybody else. So he doesn't have to explain himself to anyone, and he has the power to elevate people or teach them a lesson in humility if they speak or act over their station. About 3,000 years ago in China, some people figured out the way to get close to the king and be a royal servant is to become eunuchs through a crude procedure. I think you know the one I'm talking about. Once they do that, they cannot have children, so no heirs, so there are no political threat to the imperial dynasty. And eunuchs became a powerful class of people because they're practically next to the king all day and all night. People would bribe them to put in a good word into the king's ear. So this is apparently how far people would go to get next to powerful people. I saw a drama recently where the eunuch wasn't thinking and blurted out his opinion to the king. The king looked at him for a moment as if he was considering what the eunuch said, except he then said, "It seems lately, eunuch Huang, your tongue has been hanging a bit loose." And the eunuch immediately begged to be punished because it's better to humiliate himself than to wait for the king to do it. Now, why do you suppose Jesus quotes Solomon? What do you think the story is about that Jesus said what he said and so significant that Luke recorded it? I think he's saying that the empire's obsession with power and influence and status is stupid because they're consumed with something God doesn't care about at all. In Solomon's mind, the king has power to give someone worth or to take it away. And I think Jesus is saying, be careful who you give that power to. I'm sure you know the Hans Christian Andersen story about the emperor with no clothes. The emperor's problem starts with his vanity, his need to look good in front of people. So two swindlers manage to sell him on some magical fabric that looks fabulous to the people who matter, but would be invisible to stupid people. The emperor saw nothing on the loom, and he thought, oh no, I'm one of the stupid people. And he decided he would have to pretend to see something so he was not exposed as a fool. So he takes the livery of this invisible suit and proceeds to parade himself in front of his people. Most of us know the ending of the story as the great embarrassment to the king when the little kid who didn't know any better yelled out, "The emperor is naked." But the actual ending is worse than that. The emperor shivered, for he suspected they were right. But he thought, this procession has to go on. So he walked more proudly than ever as his noblemen held high the train that wasn't there at all. So there's a sort of dilemma. For us to grow as a person, we need feedback from people. But feedback from the wrong people can ruin us, the way it ruins the naked emperor. Henry Cloud says research shows over and over again that the growth process happens best and most successfully with the help of other people. Brené Brown suggests we make a short list of people we go to for feedback, and we choose them not only because their opinion matters to us, but also because they love us as we are, knowing all of our imperfections and vulnerabilities. And we can trust them to tell us the truth because they have no hidden motives except to help us get back into the arena when we fall down and mess up. The first time I went singing, I was just happy to be there. So I was not expecting it when the guy who sang all the solos asked me to take over one of them because his voice was getting tired. They didn't usually let newbies sing solos because it's a trust thing, whether someone can pull that off well every single night. And it's a bit of a seniority thing. So the second time I went singing, I was already considered a soloist. The problem was, so was everybody else. This group was very talented and experienced. So I was blown away when I was given the two tenor solos. At the end of the tour, I found myself relaxing in the same room with the leader. So I said, hey, I meant to ask you, why did you give me the tenor solos when there are clearly other people who sang better? And he said, well, because you weren't expecting it. And I figured you needed the encouragement. Those guys, they were all expecting it. So I thought they could use a lesson in humility. Well, his leadership did wonders for the group because everybody stopped competing with each other for individual glory and decided to concentrate on making the group sound good. It surprised the management that all that talent and nobody tried to outsing each other. We became known as one of the best sounding groups they have ever put together. They said right from the first week, we sounded like we have sung together for a long time rather than people who just met. Now, the leader wasn't saying that I got the solos because of charity. He was saying that he believed I could do it more than I believed it myself. So he was going to help me figure out who I am and what I can do. The next time I went singing with him, I expected a solo, and I didn't get it. It stung at first, but I remembered what he told me about how he did these things. So I guess it was my turn to learn humility. And I welcomed the lesson because I trusted him. And because I knew God values humility. Which Proverbs 11:1-2 compares with an accurate scale at the market. Proverbs says the kind of humility God wants from us is to be exactly who we are. No need to be more or pretend to be less. This is not how we typically think of humility. And to become that, we need friends like mine who took a personal interest in helping me figure out who I am. That getting a solo and not getting a solo are both good opportunities for me to learn about me and what kind of person I want to be. Which is what Jesus says next in Luke 14 about how to use our power in the world. He says, if you're going to throw a dinner party, instead of inviting people who can help you move up in the world, why not invite people who don't get to go to these things because they have nothing to offer anyone? So they may not be able to pay back anything of worth to you, but God will reward you in the next life. See, in the Roman world, people are pretty much slotted into their station in life from birth. If you're born to the right family with power and money, then you're naturally given a seat at the table, and then it's up to you to fight your way up the ladder. But for people who are born poor, or into slavery, or have a disability, they're pretty much stuck. In the book, Everything Sad is Untrue, the writer says, everyone in Iran is told the streets in America are paved with gold. When they arrive in America, they learn three things. One, the streets in America are not paved with gold. Two, many streets in America are not paved at all. And three, they're expected to do the paving. Some places like to tell people they're the land of opportunity, but they don't say how high or steep the ladder is to success, and how it may be higher or steeper for some people because of some unfair reasons. And I think the thing Jesus is telling us is, instead of being preoccupied with our own standing in whatever club we belong to, whether it's society or church, why not use what we have to elevate the standing of others, especially those without power and are left off the A-list? This is what God cares about. Yeah. And this is how we care about what God cares about.
Yeah.
Of course, this is dumb in Roman society because there's nothing in it for us. And it may even be social suicide if we're punished for associating with the wrong people like Jesus was punished. But Jesus says our reward for social justice is in heaven. And this is how we help remake the world into a kinder, more compassionate, more livable place. There's a new Disney superhero movie, and it begins with this. What is the responsibility of those with power? Do they merely have an obligation to refrain from the misuse of that power? Or do they have a duty to protect those without it? Andy Crouch wrote a book about power called Playing God, Redeeming the Gift of Power. He says power is not the problem. It's how we use it. Power is good, and God gives us power as a gift. But the use of God-given power is corrupted in the world. And he writes what we need to do is to consider how to bring power with all its gifts and all the ways it grips us back under the lordship of the one whom every knee will eventually bow through the disciplines that put powerful people like us into their proper places. That's the purpose of a Sabbath rest day. It's why God commands his people to rest one day a week, for us to discipline our use of power through a day of not using it. Crouch says, if we find it hard to do nothing on a Sabbath, it tells us we have a spiritual illness, a power addiction in our identity, that we don't know who we are or how to be outside of what we do. And the treatment is to practice doing nothing and just resting in God. Sabbath, he writes, is prescription as well as diagnosis. The path towards a cure for us God-playing. Properly observed, Sabbath is a weekly practice of the generosity and goodness of God. Without our having to work one bit, we find we are sustained, even lavishly provided for. We taste and see that the Lord is good. What idol ever granted its worshipers this kind of rest? The promise of Sabbath's weekly festivities, not some distant holiday or vacation, but every seventh day, reorients us towards the truth about God and God's very good world. People who need elevating so they can feel their God-given dignity, because that's the people Jesus spent most of his time with and how they experience good news. And Jesus is also the Lord of the Sabbath, whom we follow every week into holy rest, where doing nothing is the most spiritual thing we do, to let the Spirit hone our relationship with power so we might learn to use power the way Jesus does. Of course, the other thing Jesus tells us with a story that is good news for people living in empire is that God's kingdom is not empire. Every seat around God's table is an honored seat. God sees us as worthy guests, and the party would not be the same without us. This is how Friedrich Buechner defines grace. Here's your life. You might never have been, but you are, because the party would not have been complete without you. There are no cheap seats in God's kingdom, so there's no need to jockey for positions or compete to be God's favorite. Take a moment, begin the conversation with God, and then a bit of Malcolm Guite. Psalm 112 is also a reading for this morning, and it's a prayer for all of us who desire light and life and rescue from empire, not just for ourselves, but for the people Jesus leads us to. Here's Malcolm Guite's version. With all, I trace his word in everything and ask his blessing on me. I delight to know his wisdom and his mercy, sing aloud of all his judgments. There's a light that shines in darkness, and the brooding dark will never put it out or comprehend it. And now I pray that Christ himself will work in me, that through my words and deeds he'll bless the world he loves, that I will never shirk the call to lend a little of his grace to all who need it, that I will not shrink from sharing all I have, that I'll redress as best I can the world's injustice, drink so deeply from the well of life that I may bring all those who thirst back to its brink. Amen.